I'd like to start our interview by saying, Nick, it's great to talk to you again. And we last spoke, actually for the first time, last October. At the time, you were putting together, I think, 5 or 6 choirs in one room to have a celebratory concert filled with music from groups that were mingling and having a chance to meet each other as well, and just an uplifting choral event. I also know that you were in your senior year at Western as studying music as well as biochemistry. So when you reached out to me and said that you'd been looking carefully at choral singing and how it's going to be changed by the COVID-19 crisis, I thought this would be great, a chance to talk to you and have our listeners hear what the choral world is going through right now specifically.
Absolutely. And I'm really excited to have this conversation. And I think it's something that is super important right now, especially since we're, you know, every day we're getting new information. And every day we're hearing other people's opinions and thoughts about, especially in the arts world, how we should proceed. And so I thought specifically with choral music, it might be interesting to talk about because choral music over the last couple of months has gotten a lot of press. And, you know, not necessarily for the things that we want it to, right? And so I think the way we'll start today is just talking about probably the thing that everybody's heard of is the choir in Washington State in Skagit County that kind of happened initially that, you know, 61 person, you know, were in the rehearsal and 32 were confirmed to have COVID-19 and 20 were probable confirmed to have it. And so basically what happened with this is they had a rehearsal, and they actually had 2 rehearsals, but they believe that the second rehearsal, I believe it was on March 13th, was the one that contributed to most of the infection. And so essentially what had happened is that they had this rehearsal. They were placed 6 to 10 inches apart. There's reports that they, you know, they did use hand sanitizer and they didn't hug or touch each other, but they weren't socially distanced in the respect that we think now, like, you know, 6 feet, 36 square feet around you at least. And it lasted 2.5 hours, and 87% of the people that were there developed coronavirus, were infected with coronavirus. And this went out really early on in the news cycle. And it really set a precedent for how people started to view choral music. And it scared a lot of people because they thought, you know, initially at least, that, you know, we're not going to have choral singing until this whole thing is over. This is obviously a case where showcases that choir can transmit the virus at a higher rate or, you know, contribute to super emitters or super spreaders or things like that. And it really scared a lot of people in the choral world, in choir directors, in arts administrators, and in universities and public schools. But the thing that we started to realize after this is that there were a lot of other factors that contributed to the fact that these individuals may have developed COVID-19 other than choir itself, other than the act of singing. And so, like I said initially, the length of time is spent in this rehearsal is 2.5 hours, which is a very long amount of time to be in another room with a bunch of people. Also, they spent 40 minutes in that room, and then they split into 2 groups for another 50-minute practice, with one group moving to a smaller room, so a smaller-sized room. And then they all came back together. They had a 15-minute break where they ate snacks and drank and all that sort of thing, had a socializing time, and then they came back for another 45-minute session. And so what we know now, and I'll probably go into this a little bit later, but what we know now is that time of exposure and time spent with other individuals, in contact with other individuals, is really an important factor in the transmission of the virus. It makes a significant impact whether we spend 30 minutes with an individual or in a group, or if we spend an hour. And there's actually a significant difference between infection rates. And so the reason I wanted to touch on this a little bit, like I said, is because it kind of scared a lot of people. And it set a precedent to not just us as choir directors, but administrators around the country that, you know, we can't do singing or we can't do activities that require you to be in larger groups because the risk is just too high, rather than looking at, you know, what other factors may have contributed to this. And, you know, there's other things, and this is all coming from the CDC report. You can look it up online about what they went through when they evaluated this. But the median age of those who became ill was 69 years old. And so a very, very high age. 52 of the 60 attendees became ill. 32 cases were confirmed, and then 20 were considered to have probable infections. They were never actually confirmed cases. And then 3 patients were hospitalized, and 2 passed away due to the coronavirus. So the CDC essentially said, as far as the act of singing itself, they stated that in the report that they brought out about this specific case, that the act of singing itself might have contributed to SARS-CoV-2 transmission. However, attendees had multiple opportunities for droplet transmission from close contact, being next to each other for such an extended period of time.
This was an alarming story, partly because I think at that point I had been most concerned with disinfecting surfaces. This also kind of put out there that this virus transmits through the air so easily. So I think it was really held up as this warning story as relates to, you know, air transmission.
Absolutely. And I absolutely agree with you. And I think it's developed now more to where we understand that, you know, it's not really just singing that contributes to this sort of thing, but it's, like you said, transmission via close contact with each other, transmission via droplets, that is really the primary mode of transmission. And the CDC actually changed their language a little bit ago to state that surfaces are not the main way of transmission, essentially. They're not the main way the virus is transmitted. Rather, it's transmitted, what they believe at least, is mostly by close contact droplet transmission. But yes, you're totally correct. It was a very alarming story. And there were other stories like this that we heard about, I believe, in Britain and in Germany and in other places where it was the same thing, where, you know, choirs rehearsed. And they developed, COVID-19 infections. Even in places like Germany, there was a singing ban in congregations. And I haven't read up as that if it's still in place, but there's a singing ban in congregations because of that specific thing. It just set the precedent for choral music and how are we going to move forward. And so, as far as the guidance, the current guidance as far as what choir looks like. And so this is coming from the CDC. So essentially, they recommend that you consider suspending or decreasing the use of choir or musical ensembles and congregant singing, chanting, or reciting during services. So not only to include singing, but also reciting. So reciting during certain passages or reciting in the congregation. The act of singing may contribute to the transmission of COVID-19, possibly through the emission of aerosols. And now this is something that is new, and it's actually pretty controversial, not just in choir, but in the development of the COVID-19 crisis, is whether this can be transmitted via aerosols as well. Now, the biggest difference between droplets and aerosol emission is that essentially droplets are much larger particles, essentially water particles that can carry viral particles, and that was believed to be the primary mode of transmission. Now there's some evidence, some controversial evidence to indicate that it may also be transmitted via aerosols, which are the smaller particles that they can evaporate in the air and also carry viral particles. And those are much easily more spread, and they can remain in the air for longer amounts of time. And the data is pretty, it's very, very new. I mean, there was just an article that came out a couple days ago that said, you know, the particles could remain in the air for up to 16 hours. I've seen some that said that it can remain up in the air for 3 hours. And so it really just depends on conditions. And we'll talk about that a little bit, what the research looks on. But specifically within choir, there's not, and the act of singing, or even wind ensembles, bands, things like that, the data is very, very new. And the data is really not here yet. There's a famous study that's being conducted right now. I believe it's at it's a collaboration between the University of Colorado, but it's basically looking at specifically how does this virus transmit in choirs and also bands. And so what does the aerosol transmission look like? How long does it remain in the air? Are there higher risks for this sort of thing? And actually the first really early on results were just posted via a PowerPoint presentation a couple days ago. It's not much data that's specifically for choir. They looked at individual singers, and they showcased that essentially these aerosols could remain around for a while. And they looked at that with standard HVAC systems, so standard air systems and things like that. So we're just starting to learn about what choir, how singing affects the transmission. And the other thing is that, these singing releases aerosols, and, you know, speaking does as well, but the information that we still don't know is how much does it take, right? How many of these little particles of speaking or singing does it take to actually increase infection or to cause an infection? How long does it take these particles remain in the air, you know, based on light, UV light, HVAC systems? What do the air quality systems look like? How big does the room have to be? And so there are just all these different factors that are important in mitigating risk, which we're just getting new information on every single day.
I would like to tell listeners that Nick and I are speaking here on July 17th. So this information is evolving very quickly. Nick Sinkowitz is a choral conductor and a science graduate now?
Yes, I graduated in April.
Well, congratulations with both of your fields of study. Biochemistry was your field at WMU. And I think that puts you in a unique position to talk about the arts and choral performance from the perspective of someone who you've, you know, the scientific process is ingrained in your outlook, you know, and trust in trial and error and what we're going through. So for me, I'm not as grounded in that, in science. And so I'm always just desperate for these takeaways. Do I do this or do I not do this?
Mm-hmm.
And the uncertainty is a real burden because we just don't have enough answers. And
You're right.
I think what I would love for you is to give me a pep talk on how scientists are working on these problems in a way where we will have real answers. It just takes a little time.
Absolutely. And I will give you a pep talk right now.
Please do.
So scientists are working so, so hard. And I mean, it's incredible, not just in the musical realm, but also when you're looking at vaccine development. The way that we are able to expedite these processes, scientists, I mean, literally working around the clock to be able to develop these sort of things. So, for example, with vaccine development, vaccines take a really, really long time to develop because not only do we have to figure out what type of vaccine do we want to create. So do we use a vaccine that, you know, has a dead virus in it in order to create an immune response to develop antibodies? Do we use one with a mixture of dead and modified viruses? So basically, you modify the genetic information so that it's a weaker virus, so that it doesn't actually infect you, but you still get the immune response. Or do we work with something that we really haven't tried before, which is developing, you know, an RNA, a genetic-based vaccine that will create an immune response? And it's incredible that, and I mean, you're seeing it around the country, but I just looked at a webpage the other day that's tracking basically where we are in clinical trials. And so essentially what happens is that you develop a vaccine, for example, you test it to make sure that it actually works, you know, in animal models, and then you move on to clinical trials in humans. And so essentially you have one phase one, two, and three clinical trials. And in usual cases, I mean, it can take years to just develop the vaccine to make sure it works, and then even longer to see if the vaccine is effective and safe in human populations. And even just yesterday, I heard the announcement that the team led by, you know, Dr. Anthony Fauci, the, you know, one of the most trusted disease experts in the country right now, his team has moved into phase three clinical trials for vaccine development, which involves getting, I believe they were doing a cohort of 30,000 volunteers, and that they were going to start testing on that, and that the vaccine is a RNA-based vaccine, which is fairly uncommon to be used, and it was shown in phase two clinical trials to develop the neutralizing antibodies that were necessary in order to give immunity for infection. And essentially, I mean, all the data, you know, is pretty is not, you know, leaked out to the public because it's proprietary information for the most part. So they don't want everybody, you know, to take the idea or to have all this information and to, you know, use it for other purposes. But what it looks like right now is that, you know, it's a 1 month. You get it at the beginning of 1 month, and then you get it a booster essentially a month after. But it's shown to be super, super effective, and it works. And so now we're moving on to phase three. And if all goes as planned, then they said that by the end of the year, we should have a vaccine ready to go.
Well, you know that here in Kalamazoo, Pfizer is also working in conjunction with another company to do its own vaccine. Is there a possibility that we could have like 2-3 competing vaccines on the market or just available? Or do you think they'll pack it in if the Moderna trials come out positively?
Well, you know, it could be a matter of who gets to it first. It could also be a matter of, you know, the phase three clinical trials. Now we're using a large population, and it's a diverse population in many different respects. So in age, in ethnicity, in background, and possibly even in current diseases, you know, pre-existing conditions. So, for example, the phase two clinical trials of the one done by Dr. Fauci's team only tested on young adults. You know, people, I believe it was from 20 to 30 years old, essentially. And so you could move on to a phase three clinical trial and the vaccine causes an immune response in older individuals that wasn't expected or doesn't create the immunity that you need in children. And so what's definitely a possibility is that we start to go through these phase three clinical trials and that some of the vaccinations don't work, right? And that's why it's so contenting to know that there are multiple vaccines. Like you said, there's one with Pfizer, and I believe there's another one out of Germany that are all in phase three clinical trials right now. And there's a bunch more in phase two, and there's a bunch more in phase one. And so there's all these vaccines that could potentially move on, all looking at different things. So like I said, could possibly using, you know, the dead virus, or could be using RNA. So even if one might not work, we definitely have another one that could, you know, possibly be a good vaccine candidate.
I'm speaking with Nick Sinkowitz, who's taking a very science-based look at virus transmission, especially in the coral world. So are you telling other coral conductors that the sky hasn't completely fallen in? Are you saying there's paths forward, or what nuances are you trying to express?
I think the nuance that is most important is the idea that arts, you know, arts are essential. especially in a time, you know, of a pandemic. Arts are absolutely essential, not only, you know, in the higher education realm, as far as university goes, but also in high schools and in middle schools and in elementary schools. We need to find a way in order to not stop these activities, because, you know, that leads to the defunding of these programs, you know, loss of staff. And also, there's, you know, there's so much data that showcases, I was just reading a new article yesterday talking about actually the participation of student athletes. I believe it was the University of Wisconsin did a study during COVID-19, and they interviewed a bunch of these student athletes. And they basically looked at what happened after the schools closed and they weren't able to do athletics anymore, for example. And after the March shutdown of schools, 68% of the state student athletes in Wisconsin reported symptoms of depression. And that's not to necessarily say, right, that the fact that they weren't in athletics anymore led to depression. But it's an interesting thought to have, that it basically showcased that these high school sports and these activities in kids are vital to social, emotional, and the mental health of high school students. And so rather than finding ways that to cut these programs, we need to find ways, just like we're doing for, you know, our history, our English, our math, and our science classes, to mitigate risk in the arts. So the message, I guess I'm saying, is that rather than canceling these programs or defunding these programs or, you know, taking away money or completely abolishing programs, we need to think about ways in order to mitigate risk in the choral art form and in arts in general.
It's like the difference between sort of existing and really living is the chance to participate in art or sports or group human activities.
Absolutely. And the reason, you know, it seems like we're constantly, as arts educators as a whole, constantly in a battle, right, for arts education, for arts and music and all that sort of dance, you know, all theater, all that sort of thing as essential. And it's because, you know, of the move towards schools that we have to be able to use standardized testing in order to test students. So we need to be able to see growth in order to get funding. And, you know, sometimes it's hard to do that in music. Sometimes it's difficult to do that in theater and things like that, because there's more to, you know, just music and the arts than, you know, it's standardized testing, than looking at growth. And, you know, music teaches us, it guides us to recognize beauty. It allows us to develop insight. You know, we use all sorts of learning techniques, kinesthetic, auditory, visual, in music. It reaches so many at-risk students. It's so essential. And that's why, like I said, we need to find ways to mitigate risk. Like you said, living through this rather than cutting it. Because what is the case if this goes on longer than we expect it to? Or what is the case if we approach a situation like this in the future? We have to make sure that we're ready to take on the task.
I'm very accustomed to any U.S. administration really not having, and our lawmakers not having, the arts on the top of their to-do lists or agenda. It's just way down low on their priorities and has been for my lifetime. But I am surprised that this administration has taken such a compromised view of science that... saying one thing one day and saying the opposite the other day, and not trusting the scientific process, which is probably the only thing we can trust. It's something humans developed that really works, building on past provables to better understand our world.
That statement I read by the CDC about, you know, suspending or decreasing use of choir musical ensembles, actually, the day after they sent out that guidance, it was removed and changed by our current administration to say just to promote social distancing rather than, you know, the explicit protocols or the explicit wording of the CDC about what you should do. It was modified by the administration. So just like you were saying, every single day we get information that's from scientists, or from research or from data, and then it's changed or modified in order to fit the current narrative.
That must be so frustrating for you and your science colleagues.
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. And it's just, even as science as a whole, I started my undergrad 3 years ago and really started digging into the sciences then with research and working at various chemical companies and things like that. And the distrust that we have in current science and in current research is very disappointing. I think it's mostly due to the idea that it's hard, one, for, you know, us to go and read all of these journal articles, you know, for the, you know, the Journal of the American Chemical Society and the Journal of Biological Chemistry. And even for us, I was just talking to, I'm working with a group of students right now for Project Seed, and I was talking about, as a chemist, trying to read a biology paper, you know, a journal in biology, it's really hard. It, you know, it takes a couple hours to get through and understand what this data actually means. And so we rely as a general population on new sources to interpret that data for us. And over the last couple of years, especially with this administration, we've developed such a distrust in the media that we can't go to those sources in order to understand what this data truly and actually means. And so you're absolutely right. It's definitely frustrating as a scientist, even as the general public, to have to try to understand this ourselves in a time where science is so distrusted, in a time where it needs to be trusted.
Nick, may I ask you how you personally have come through these last few months? You graduated in April, but you weren't able to attend graduation.
It's been hard. I'll say it's been really, really hard. I was working with a children's chorus through the Kalamazoo Children's Chorus that had to be canceled. You know, I work as a music director at a church that was canceled. Everybody's going through the same experiences. And it's been really tough trying to understand how to cope with this situation where, like you said, there is so much uncertainty without also being able to really connect with other people on the level that we usually do is so hard. And, you know, I'll quote my favorite person of all time, Brené Brown, when she talks about that we are hardwired for connection as human beings. And so trying to get through this time without being able to really engage with others in the way that we usually do, it was really, really hard. And I'm also pursuing my master's in choral conducting at Indiana University Bloomington this fall. And just the uncertainty of what is that going to look like? You know, how am I as an educator going to make sure that my students are safe? How is the university that I'm going to make sure students are safe while still allowing them to get the education that they are paying for and the education that they deserve? It's very uncertain. And so I've just kind of leaned into that uncertainty and understand that, you know, this is something that's out of my control. And that's the worst thing, and it's the best thing, because we have absolutely no control over what we do except how we make sure others are safe. But as far as, you know, vaccine development goes, as far as how the COVID-19 pandemic is playing out in the U.S. and in other countries, we don't have control over that. So we kind of have to grieve and settle into this idea of that it's going to be uncertain and it's going to be okay.
Well, with your brain power and talent, I have a feeling you'll be one of those that helps lead us through this. And Nick, I was wondering, I'm going to spring this on you, so no pressure, but could I play a piece of music for you that at your request after this interview, something that is seems appropriate to you, music that shares a message or a feeling that that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Absolutely. You're talking about a piece of music that I'd like to share that would send like a message of hope or, you know, moving forward or something like that.
Or something that's just giving you solace these days.
Sure. So something that really gives me, and it's going to sound very funny, but I'm a very nature person. And so during this pandemic, something I'd love to do is go outside and I practice yoga. And so go outside and just practice yoga and just be outside in the sun and anything like that. So something that I listen to, and I'm actually not a very religious person by by any means. But it's a piece called, it's a choral piece called I Thank You God. And it's it was actually done, I believe it was done by the Messiah's College Choir is the recording you might have to look for. But it's a wonder. I mean, it's just a wonderful piece. It was actually done by the Austin McWilliams, who I believe you talked to the other day for his graduate recital about HIV and AIDS awareness. But it's a piece that's basically thanking God, essentially, but it just in general thanking the world for this beautiful, pristine, amazing day that we have. And so even before the pandemic, whenever I was feeling down, whenever I was feeling sad, I would just play this song in my car. or embracing those times where we had joy in my life. Sometimes, you know, during this, we tend to focus on negative things that are happening to us or things that are bad. And sometimes it's nice to lean into joy and acknowledge the moment during this time that we find joyful. And so, yeah, I Thank You God by Elliot Levine by the Messiah's College Concert Choir is probably one of the best pieces.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you. Have a great day.